The following Dharma talk was given by Ron Hogan Green. Hogan Sensei is a lay teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org.
Thanks for listening.
Good morning. This poem is called Snow. All my life, false and real, right and wrong, tangled. Playing with the moon, ridiculing the wind, listening to birds. Many years wasted, seeing the mountain covered with snow. This winter, I suddenly realized snow makes the mountain. So this is a poem by Master Dogen, years 1200 to 1253. And it's a poem I've always been completely intrigued with. And so I think a good place to start is the question, what makes us whole? How does that happen? All my life, right and wrong, me, you, beliefs and assumptions that I didn't even know were within me, that I acted out of, held up my bottom line. This is who I am. Got it? You got it? I got it. Creating myself, without the need to look deeply past my feelings of myself. Sometimes confused about my body, my thoughts, my fears, and especially my desires. Sometimes thinking I was very clear on them, only to lead to further confusion as I acted on them. And even within our journey towards clarity, we may practice by drawing a line in the sand. In fact, I think that's inevitable. And that line limits the way I understand my thoughts and emotions. And I refuse to cross it. It's in its own strange way working for me. And that's the limit of my knowledge. Or from another perspective, that's the limit of my ignorance. And within that, we deny ourselves to be free within the teachings, within feelings, within judgments. And we do know at some level that they create harm. Yet, it's not important enough to us, perhaps. And we can close our eyes and do what we create out of our karmic self, out of our past and the past that have been bequeathed us, and just go about our business. And that's my life. That's who we are. We live in a society that conspires to encourage this, to live without foundational roots, or to think our foundation is our desires and our fears and what we want, what we don't want. And encourage us to trust that. And what we were offered, those offerings, with a plastic smile and illusionary dreams and sometimes literally naked appeal. And yet in this poem, Dogen is expressing the identical challenges we all face with our tendencies and automated responses and our willfully conditioned and solicited blindnesses. And we should understand that spiritual practice is not necessarily exempt from that. In this relational world of me and you, where sometimes we face choices that result in difficulty, in criticism, or even harm, no matter what decisions we make, what can we rely on to allow us to stand upright and face what is before us with a very clear intention? And most of all, what is crucial, at least from a Buddhist perspective of acknowledgement of our suffering and others' suffering, is how do we live a life of wholeness and profound integrity that does not rely on our self-centered perspectives that society bribes us to blindly accept as the totality of ourselves. It bribes us, it's offering us that. And also in some dim way, for some of us, we know there is a path that cuts through the entanglements. Or perhaps to put it another way, brings into visibility. So we now have some power and ability to look closely at them and see how they arise and where they truly come from. And that they're not random. They are us. And so it's important when, as we begin to examine our lives, to explore this way, this Tao, that the exploration include and holds ourselves without squeezing us into another tighter box now called the Dharma. And so that's there too, right? We have our ideas of how the Dharma should be, and we're going to make ourselves fit or judge others who we feel don't fit. In other words, we bring ourselves to the Dharma and think that's it. And of course, in another way, it is it. But to dig deeply into that and to experience the boundary of that thought offers us a way to be free in a way we cannot envision from that box, be it of Dharma or the craziness of this larger life. The Tao, the way, the path, is always right before us. Where else could it be? So as we practice, we continue to learn to trust this path, which is not outside ourselves, and to trust that this way is genuine and verifiable by our own experience. It's only by our own experience that it's verifiable. It's not someone else's experience. And I mention that because yesterday we had a retreat on the precepts, and I know I kept pounding away, this is yours, this is yours. These are not rules. These are guidelines to consider, and they're not on the surface. And your way and my way of understanding that, that the basis in this practice of Zen is on the compassionate application of our life, that it does our best in our own clumsy way to uphold the precepts. And that is based on the insight that comes out of our Zazen and our practice. So it's far from rules, far from even strong suggestions, if you will. It's much more personal than that. It's much more powerful than that because it is so personal. What is that personal? Your own full Buddha nature in this package of you that we can't advance to. We can't take a step towards and manifest. We have to get out of the way to let that light shine because we're trained to block the light. We're trained to be me. And without in any way disregarding me, to see what this me is. A cardinal signpost of walking this path, the path of the Bodhisattva, is to go right towards when difficulties arise. That's where blindness is. There are inherently no difficulties. And yet our life is filled with them, isn't it? The challenges, the brambles. And on and on, there are difficulties that we can't understand out of our confusion, how they occurred. Because clearly I know my way. And inevitably we're knowing our way. We are our way and we're attached to our way. You don't know my way. You got your way. And from that perspective of not knowing each other in the sense that I'm speaking of, difficulties will arise. I do my best to rest in Wei Ning's understanding, and I've studied this in a non-academic sense, it's a clumsy way of putting it, non-conceptual sense, within my own practice. When he said, when others are wrong, I too am wrong. When I am wrong, I alone am wrong. What a remarkable statement. What a remarkable entry point to explore how I create suffering for myself and for you. To acknowledge when others are wrong, I too am wrong. How is that even possible? From what perspective does that come from? Clearly not. It's about me and nobody else. Clearly not. Well, I'm absolving you of ever being wrong. It's always mine. That ain't it. And yet, there's the statement. And that has inspired me to carefully consider, to take that up as a personal teaching. And not as a success or failure. That doesn't work. That's relative and measurable and measuring and doesn't help me in any way. But as a deep and profound understanding, and out of that in the relative world, doing the best I can with my own reactions to when I think you're wrong, or when I think I'm wrong, and what is the relationship between that? I've observed, one of the ways I've observed this is in any difficult, quote, conversation, difficult relationship that I've seen, at least from a karmic perspective, it always takes two. It always takes two who are making that relationship work in that difficult way. And you have to be careful with the kind of statement like that, because in a limited way you can blame someone who's obviously been deeply wronged. But from a karmic perspective, that changes the whole thing. That deep influence on each of us beyond this immediate life, from our parents, from our society, from our gender, from our education, from our great-great-parents, from our great-great-great-great-parents, and how far back do you want to go? That karma is here in me and you. And there's wrongness in that. That's been given to me as a way of understanding myself and you. It creates suffering. And here I am practicing trying to address that. No simple thing. I better be ready to be flexible in my thoughts and ideas and not buy into everything I think. It's not easy to hold ourselves accountable in this relative world. And there aren't a lot of models. I mean, we've all seen the politicians apologize and go, you know, that's an apology? You know, would I accept that from my lover or my child? You know, or from me? Yeah, I'm responsible for what I did. Screw you, is the meta message. You know, you don't count. So take that up in consideration of the wholeness, and when others are wrong, I too am wrong, the wholeness of nothing being left out. And when I am wrong, another perspective entirely, I'm wrong. And to hold that, you know, Dido put this a very different way, quoting from a very famous book, we're responsible for the whole catastrophe, this world. That's our responsibility. We're in it. In investigating this, it's not about me as we might usually understand me, as separate and apart from others. At the same time, the me arises and comes forth from the largeness of our Buddha nature. So me is not excluded. Please understand that. But our sense that it's just me is excluded. Because that is a lie. That is a mistruth. That is a misunderstanding that creates endless harm. Realizing this intimately is what Dogen is pointing to in his poem, and what the Bodhisattva path is. And trying to pin this down within thought and intellection is a futile game. Not that I haven't tried to do that, or that we shouldn't try and do that. That's an entry point to examine it and to hold it up, and at some point to realize it only goes so far. And so to take it up in our zazen, to take it up in our exploration of the precepts, what does that mean? Playing with the moon ridiculing the wind, listening to the birds. There really is a word, by the way, ridiculing. I looked it up because I never encountered it before, but okay. So playing with the moon, ridiculing the wind, listening to the birds. Many years wasted seeing the mountain covered with snow. The world seems almost designed to estrange us from ourselves, our true selves. And everyone's path back from that alienation is unique and different. And yet we're all in it together. As Freud noted, resorting to alcohol and drugs, and by extension, fantasy, our electronics, our entertainment, our sports, to distract ourselves from being present with ourselves, is a spiritual problem. It doesn't work very well to examine it from the mechanicalistic proper way to proceed and to address this problem. The problem is much more fundamental. The problem is me. And it's not outside me. Me and my sense of me. And it should be, I hope it is apparent, that inherently there's nothing wrong with technology or entertainment or following sports. We all do some variation of that, fantasizing. But when that becomes the gateway to flee from our life, then it becomes a problem for our life. And one of the reasons this poem fascinates me is it can only be written by someone like you and I who have been trapped by his karmic tendencies. You can't write a poem like that unless you know it from the inside out. You can't fake that. Master Dogen? Get off your fucking pedestal and join the Sangha. Forgive my directness, but that's how I felt. But I put him on the pedestal, and I have to take him off. It's not that his teachings aren't genuine and profound and teach me constantly. This whole monastery is based on his teachings. But what am I doing with that? How do I understand it? So he says, playing with the moon, ridiculing the wind, listening to birds. And you can understand there's nothing inherently wrong with any one of those. Gazing at the moon, I mean, it's wonderful. Listening to the wind, hearing the sounds of birds, it's wonderful. Looking at the cherry tree outside, wow. But how do we understand playing and seeing and listening? How do we understand seeing another person, being with another person, and listening to another person? Many years wasted covering, seeing the mountain covered with snow. Why is it wasted seeing the mountain covered with snow? From one perspective, this is how we ordinarily see things. Oh, it's a cherry tree, wonderful, beautiful. Oh, maybe it's a cherry tree, awe-inspiring. That out there is the cherry tree. I'm here. So subtly present in our mind. Some of you have worked in the cypress tree in the garden of Koan, which is the answer to the question, I don't remember the exact wording, what is the Buddha's fundamental teaching? And Joshua says, the cypress tree in the garden, the cherry tree in the front yard. How could that be? So, the ordinary way of seeing things, a mountain covered with snow, a rain puddle on the sidewalk, spring flowers, the breeze, seeing each other, you as you, me as me. What's the problem with any of these? How is that being wasted? And I might add from another perspective, it may not be wasted. And seeing our delusions and seeing what comes out of our delusions, it's necessary to waste the time to get to the point where we say, no, I will no longer accept my craziness. I just won't. And that point may be very specific and concrete, or it may be a gradual realization that there's much more to me seeing and listening and hearing and being with each other than my accustomed way of doing that. And also, I think many of us, if not most of us, have glimpses of that where we forget ourselves. And we're not seeing the tree, cherry tree, we are the cherry tree. Now, what does that mean? Words don't capture it. But we are that. How does the common way of seeing things seem to create a sense of distance and separation when fundamentally that doesn't exist? The truth is always right before us. Whatever the Buddha Dharma must be, it has to be right here, right now. Can't be someplace else. To take up this path of wisdom and compassion means to bring it forth within the specifics of our life, in our relationship with each other, with all beings, and with our being. And implied in that statement, within the specifics of your life, is your specifics, is not my specifics. So you have to find your way in your life, and I have to find my way in my life. And they're not going to be the same. Although we have a path, we have a way to guide us, but in the nitty-gritty details of walking that path, each step has to be yours. And it's going to be different than mine. And that's really important in this practice. If I have a troubling relationship that causes harms, that causes harm as it must, this is mine. Yeah, you have your contribution. But in a way, that's not my business. My business is, what did I contribute to this? And that's not particularly a popular way of looking at relationship, not just between people, but anything currently. But I'm not talking from a psychological perspective. There is some value in the psychological perspective. And if that's what you want, you can go get that. I'm talking from the perspective of you and I are one, even though I'm not you and you're not me. And frankly, in living this in the relative world, I don't know about you, but I'm clumsy in that. I don't consider myself particularly skillful, but I do the best I can with my limited tools. And I keep trying, and I keep trying, and I keep trying. Sentient beings, alive, dead, deluded, human beings doing evil things, human beings doing tremendously good things, all of us are in relationship with each other. It's not so important that others practice the Dharma. Again, in a particular way, that's not our business. That's up to them. And it's one of the reasons we claim, at least in Zen, that we don't solicit. Because that is profoundly disrespectful of the person's karma and life, which is theirs. And we have no right, unless They ask to offer our own experience and would-be wisdom. What is important is that we ourselves take up these relationships in a manner that allows us and encourages us to bring forth our inherent compassion, our inherent wisdom, which we all have. Interestingly enough, this is not a goal. It's a practice. It's an aspiration. And in that aspiration, we aspire to forget ourselves as we practice the Bodhisattva way. Forget ourselves doesn't mean we don't exist or we're not acknowledging ourselves. We're not placing our sense of me forward. And although I'm not articulating that very well, I think you all know what I'm talking about. And we should not forget that includes the Bodhisattva. There's no such thing as a Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva who practices is not a Bodhisattva. They're no thing any more than any other thing is a thing. And by holding that and seeing into that, we can step forth as a Bodhisattva, at least within our practice, understanding that there's never been a Bodhisattva. It's ephemeral. It's an idea. It's not a thing. Another milder way, if you will, of saying that is it's a practice. It's not a thing. It's a verb, not a noun. Does that make sense? I came across a piece by Norman Fisher, which I fairly heavily edited, but thank you, Roshi Fisher. He's a contemporary Zen teacher. And he says, through edited words, related to this are some comments. Practice, then, is both a sudden, we have flashes of insight, and a gradual, it develops over a lifetime, identity shift. And that's exactly what it is. You know, at the age of 20, if I came across someone exactly like me, get out of here. You're not real. Because you wouldn't have been real to me at the age of 20. What was real was me. It's a profound identity shift, which we never see coming. And we can't measure. As we practice, though, we gradually gain confidence in our original enlightenment. That's what the Buddha realized. All beings are whole and complete from the beginning. You, when he says all beings, he's being very personal. He's pointing his finger at each of us. You are originally enlightened, which is and has always been at the center of our lives, despite all that we've assumed about our limitations and imperfections and deficits and our internal criticisms. The awakening of faith says the state of enlightenment is not something that is to be acquired by practice or created. And that can be pretty humbling to earnest practitioners, right? There's the goal, head towards it, we got it. I know because I practiced that way for a long time. Fit right into my personality profile. Show me the goalpost and I'm going to go there. And if you get in my way, look out. So we practice that way, often without even realizing it. Maybe not quite so dramatically as I'm putting it, but you know, our experience is something to get. But you can't get it. It's unobtainable because it's been present the whole time. So what realization is the realization of your completely full perfection as you are, which does not exclude some improvement, as a famous teacher said. Is there a time to see things as separate and apart? Usually we call that delusion. Is there a time to see them that way? Is there a time to see that all things are one, vast body, your body? Is there a time to just see? What determines that? What determines how to see each other or the cherry tree? I hope it's a cherry tree, but it doesn't matter. Compassion. That's the Mahayana path, your purpose in seeing. Well, what about when I don't see? That's called practice. You practice not seeing so that gradually or suddenly you do see. And that can only happen with some awareness of yourself. We call that awareness Zazen, cultivation of that. Whatever is being offered by others is for you. A teaching to help you deeply investigate, see beyond the superficial, and realize the entirety of our being. So let me state this in another way. Whatever offends you is meant for you. It's yours. You're offended. Now, how will you turn that towards the Dharma? How will you make it work for you in such a way that is not destructive, doesn't destroy you, doesn't destroy your understanding of the other person, and leads you to the realization of wholeness and completeness? That's your practice. That is the practice. That's always the practice. Do we realize, amid our reactions to others, that this is now a bodhisattvic opportunity? We can rest in our resentment and, you know, if you didn't do that, my life would be perfect and whole and I'd be a lot happier. But that is not true. In a little moment it would be, an annoyance is removed, perhaps if I clobber you verbally or some other way, but there's a karma to that that is not removed. Imagine the events of your life and the suffering of your life through the lens of a non-dual perspective, through the lens of wholeness. And that's difficult, perhaps impossible to imagine, but through an understanding of karma and the desire to awaken, that possibility beckons us. And there's no way to know how to do this. How do I deal with my resentment or my anger or my thoughts about someone and my judgments in a way that is helpful? You have to find your way in that. And it's not a yes or no. It's not click a switch and it happens. It's a struggle sometimes. Or sometimes we can't, and we know we can't. We have to let it be until we can. And that's okay. That's the paramita of patience, as long as we're doing our best to understand and enter into the situation. And that happens many, many, many times. It's probably an essential feature of practice. I don't understand what Wei Ning is saying now. I can't. I've worked with it for years. Oh, I have a glimmer. Oh, it opens up for me. Oh, it's my life. We say in the Fusatsu ceremony that we'll hold next week and next month and occasionally other times, being one with the Sangha, with all sentient beings, lead the people. Let harmony pervade everywhere. What does it mean to lead the people? I asked that in the workshop yesterday. And right on, the answer was, practice the bodhisattva, your bodhisattva path, to the best of your ability. Set an example. It's not walking out front. Oh, follow me. It's much more subtle than that. Your practice is much more subtle than that. And that is, our practice is an offering, always. But I've only been practicing a week. That's your offering. It's whole and complete just as it is. So I was thinking in regard to this of a quiz show of my childhood, which I was fascinated by but didn't quite get. It's, you may, us oldies, remember it. It's called Whom Do You Trust? And they would take a couple and then separate them, and they'd ask one of the couple a question. And sometimes the questions for the 1950s were pretty intimate. And then they'd ask the partner, separated, this, what do you think your partner said? I don't know how many divorces this led to. But the question is, whom do you trust? Who? The name of the program was Whom, so I'm assuming that's grammatically correct. I didn't do well in grammar. Because we live in the relative world, it's easy to get tangled in false and real, right or wrong. The path can only guide us. Our idea and our lives about our idea are ours alone to live and die with. The Buddha Dharma points to a path that, as we practice, becomes clearer and clearer to us in particular. Gradually, we can see it right before us. Gradually, we can feel that all our reactions, positive or negative, to each other, to a teacher, to what is being offered as the path, is a clear invitation to explore, not to accept or reject, to explore. As Daito Roshi used to frequently say, it's not that we forgot to take out a part of this teaching. It's there for a reason. So I'm looking at my relationship to Shantideva, who, when I first encountered Shantideva, who Shubin loves, I just couldn't enter it. I couldn't relate to it. So I put it down, I tried again, I put it down, I tried again. And now I find myself quoting Shantideva. Shantideva must have enormously changed. And that's the way it is. I was thinking of Daito Roshi, and if you've been around a while and never met Daito Roshi, you're talking about someone who's extremely complex, a genius in many ways, many areas. And I was thinking about my relationship to him as my teacher. And I mentioned in the workshop yesterday how I saw him time and time again make decisions about, real important decisions about this place and what will happen, what could happen in the future, or what was happening in the difficulties of the present. And they were so often different than the way I would have concluded. And recognizing that the wisdom of his decisions was not something I had, so to speak, or could relate to, but recognizing that it was wise, that it was right on. What I didn't say is all the times he made the decisions, usually that in some subtle way affected me directly, that I did agree with. that I thought he was wrong. There's no arrogance there whatsoever. But I was in a place of trust enough to examine that, to be patient with it, and to understand that his viewpoint and his karma that led to that viewpoint, and knowing enough about it, was very different than my karma. How he understood intimate relationship with a person, a romantic relationship, and how I understood were completely different. And I understood his karma, and I understood this place would not exist as it does without him making both the sacrifices and some harm that he caused within his intimate relationships. This place would not be, you would not be here without it. I would not be here without it. And I also understood that was not me. That was not how I understood personal, loving relationship to a partner. And so I respected that. I respected his karmic precursors to these decisions, which for me would have been wrong, but for him were correct. And that ultimately, and I was involved in many of them, and some of them were really challenging and really difficult, and you folks who have been around know this. And I was in the midst of these sometimes battles. And I came to understand that within my not understanding, he was completely him, and realized that. And I was completely me and trying to realize that. And now respecting his decisions from a whole other perspective, because I understood the difference between them being wrong for me and being right or wrong independent of me, and being right for him. And that allowed me to hold him as a human being during the crucial times when I had to ask myself, can I continue to train with him? Because da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And the answer each time in this lifetime with him was always yes, ultimately. But I had to examine that. I had to understand in a deep way that I had previously not been capable of, that he was teaching me out of his karma, running and dedicated to this place out of his karma, out of the particulars of his background, which I could not share in any direct way. Well, that's true of you and you and you and you and you and me. Someone asked me about relationship with people who have gone. That actually was with Dido. But I'm thinking about my relationship with my mother, birth mother, who died, who I have no memories of when I was two. And at a point of ongo for me when I decided to take that up. Who is she? Who was she? Who is she now? And how I began to explore that in minute detail, meeting with people who knew her, getting many different variable views of that, looking at what happened in my life when I received her only possession of this 30-something-year-old Jewish woman, uneducated, who had probably left Brooklyn once or twice in her life, and the possession that came into my possession from her was a statue of a bodhisattva. How the hell does that happen? How does that happen? It can't happen. And so when I say karma goes backward as well as forward, that's my experience. That completely changed my understanding of her karma and my karma, knowing nothing more about the situation other than here's the statue. So a slightly different segue. We're running out of time, aren't we? All right, I can't resist this, so please stay with me. Some of you may know Shel Silverstein. He died in 1999. But if you don't know him, you know his works, Where the Sidewalk Ends. Is that familiar to some of you? A Boy Named Sue, his song, he wrote it. The Giving Tree. And so he wrote a book. I'm not sure of actually the title, but something like The Big O. And he tells the tale of a lonely little wedge that dreams of finding a big circle into which it can fit so that together they can roll and go someplace.
The missing piece.
And we can recognize, and perhaps in our own life, how we're looking outside us for the missing piece in relationship and then even religious practice or in our partner or education or our self-judgments and so on and so forth. But we're not finding it. And so we try and adjust ourselves, right? We make ourselves more attractive or more shiny or whatever it is. But that doesn't work either. And at last, a shape comes by that looks like the one that you need. And so the missing piece introduces itself. The shape is called the Big O. And it rolls along. And the missing piece says, I think you're the one I've been waiting for. Maybe I am your missing piece, and we can fit together. And the Big O says, but I'm not missing a piece. Thank you, Buddha. There's no place you would fit. This is too bad, says the missing piece. I was hoping that perhaps I could roll with you. Well, you cannot roll with me. But perhaps you can roll by yourself. That had never occurred to the one who thought they were missing a piece. So when the Big O says, have you ever tried? I understand as trying as coming here, at least for my life. They respond, but I have sharp corners. Oh, the missing piece is the only one with the sharp corners, right? We have sharp corners. Have you ever tried rolling? The Big O says, sharp corners can wear off. Can our corners wear off? You may not be interested in smoothing your sharp corners. And you may feel that your sharp corners are caused by somebody else, but that does not affect your sharp corners. Luckily, we have our relationships, we have each other, we have the Sangha to encourage us and support us in learning to have our sharp corners wear down. So how do you go about doing that? All would-be bodhisattvas, all human beings, all of us have these sharp corners and perhaps some indented places where we've been wounded and makes it difficult to roll. So in the Shel Silverstein story, the missing piece tries and goes, and a little movement forward happens. And over time, as its edges begin to wear off and shape starts to change, gradually it begins to bounce a little bounce in its efforts, instead of bump. And then gradually it begins to roll instead of bounce. And it has always dreamed of doing this with the aid of another. But here it's doing it all by itself. So what is this? It is us. It is not knowing how, yet practicing out of faith, out of desperation, out of desire to help, out of using whatever comes along as a way to walk this path of wholeness. And when the missing piece becomes a well-rounded self, the big O comes forth silently without explanation. And in the final scene, the two are seen rolling side by side in the same direction. And that calls to mind a quote. I've never pronounced this, I've read so much of it. Antonin de Saint-Exupéry, who led a fascinating life, and I'm not going to go into it, but a remarkable life. And he said, love does not consist of gazing at each other, but in looking forward together in the same direction. That's Sangha. That is our path. Each of us rolling together in the same direction. Are we one or are we two? This winter, I suddenly realized snow makes the mountain. The snow Dogen speaks of is our true nature. It's ever present. It's beckoning for us to awaken, to see the mountain itself in its wholeness, covered with snow, which it has always been. And confirming that the deepest thing in me is the deepest thing in you. This winter, I suddenly realized that snow makes the mountain.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.